This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our intersection of discussion and intriguing ideas today, because we're going to talk about, the brave new world we're in, this rip from the headlines subject that Jack Russell Weinstein is going to be talking about this Sunday on Prairie Public Presents, Does Big Data Threaten Our Democracy? And then later on in our show, we'll talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, about the big stories of the week. And Jack, one of the biggest stories we've been talking about is about big data and elections and Amazon and Facebook and all kinds of stuff. So let's dive right into it. Your subject this week is, Does Big Data Threaten Our Democracy? And that, of course, is for your program, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. And for our listeners who are new to you, and I think there might just be a few because most of them have heard you before, Jack is the host of that program, and he is a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And this week, your guest is Kathy O'Neill. She's a mathematician and author. She's also a former hedge fund trader using the topic of the day, which is algorithms. And she's written a book called Weapons of Math Destruction. So let's dive right into it. I assume you chose this subject because it's very topical.
You know, I chose it because it was topical, but it's much more topical now than it was when I chose it. It just seems to snowball. When I first thought about the show, actually, I did it as a gift for a friend, a high school student I know who's grown up down the street. She read the book. She loved it. I thought, well, if this is interesting to her, it'll be interesting to everybody. And now it turns out that it really is interesting to everybody. It is on front page newspapers everywhere. Do you say newspapers anymore?
We read them online. Yes,
That's right. I mean, you know, it's everywhere, and it's overwhelming. It's really hard to know where to start, what question to begin with.
Well, for a person my age, this is science fiction becoming fact. What are the philosophical issues that you see in Does Big Data Threaten Our Democracy?
Well, so the way big data works is that there's a lot of information that gets sorted out by an algorithm, a mathematical formula. And so there are two ways that it can go profoundly wrong. The first is if you have the wrong data, and the second is if the algorithm itself is messed up. What Kathy is talking about is that both are problematic. In particular, the data that people use sets people up to fail to begin with, and so they choose data that leads people down a dark path, and then the algorithms support that and push people continually into a cycle. So, for example, when we talk about crime statistics, she points out that we don't really have crime statistics. We have arrest statistics, and we have reported crime statistics. And what police do is they go to places where there has historically been arrests, and they arrest more people. So that tends to happen in poor areas, in African-American areas, and so the police go there, arrest people. It confirms their suspicions that this is where the crime is, and they go about their business. But because they're not in the white areas, because they're not in the rich areas, there's no arrests there, and it confirms their suspicions that there's no crime there, when in fact there is. There are just no arrests. And so it just reinforces our prejudices and our system of inequality.
Yes, it reinforces what historically has been done, and it's now part of a data pool. What are the philosophical disciplines that we're delving into here? Is this moral and ethical philosophy?
It certainly is. It's social and political philosophy. It's ethics. It's morality. But also math is a philosophical discipline. We don't think about it that way.
Sure.
But I've taken some courses in philosophy of mathematics, and it really is about the nature of objectivity, right? Is math objective? Is math universal? Does the data takes away doubt from the everyday person, but should it? Because really, even though it looks like science and it smells like science and it tastes like science, it's not science. It's something else. And that makes us less likely to question it. And if we're less likely to question it, then we're just going to continue doing the bad things that we should be learning not to do.
Well, as a kid in school, I learned that math was sort of the pure logic, you know, but extrapolate on that.
Well, sure. Actually, for those who are interested in this sort of thing, in the late 19th, early 20th century, one of the great philosophical projects was to prove that math was at root logic. There's a very big book, three volumes by Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead called Principia Mathematica, in which they show that math is logic, and the hard part was proving that 1 plus 1 equals 2. After that, it all came right out. But what that means is that people substitute math for argument, that people substitute data for reasons, and they're not the same thing. And what Kathy wants us to understand is that we have to have a much more human level of interpretation and human level of doubt, because the math and the numbers, again, only look objective. So philosophically, we have to ask, what does it mean to know something? How do we know it? Who do we care about? What is justice? What is equality? What is privacy? What is – and most famously, following a philosopher named David Hume, why must the future be like the past, right? These algorithms are doing things because they think that, well, if there was crime there before, there'll be crime thereafter. But as we all know, the future is unpredictable.
Well, you use the critical term there, algorithms. We hear about computer algorithms. We understand that they help determine, make decisions basically based on the data that's provided. can you delve into that a bit for as a philosopher and kind of explain that to us?
Sure. So let's say that I come home after a bad day and my wife was home from work first, and she knows that after a bad day, I like to have a martini. Well, she knows that from living with me for a while, and then she'll see me come in and she'll see I have a bad day and she'll suggest I have a martini. Now, suppose we take that and look at all of our neighbors and look at all the town. What do people do when they have a bad day? Let's say 15% of people want a martini. Well, does that tell us anything about individual people? No, it only tells us that there's a 15% chance that someone will want a martini. Now, we treat those numbers like they're fact. And so the gin manufacturers, or in my case, the vodka manufacturers, show up to Grand Forks and they sell more vodka and they put it more in the more of them in the stores because they think, well, these people are having lots of bad days. They're having martinis. We're going to sell more martinis. And then I go to the store and I think, well, I don't want vodka. I want tequila. But now there's no tequila on the shelves. There's only vodka. And so I pick up the vodka. I buy it because it's what I want. And then they say, see, we were right. They wanted vodka in the first place. And what the algorithm does is create a formula for acting or for believing or for knowing based on this data, but it also limits our choices. It tells us what we can choose from in advance, and then we don't have the opportunity to do anything else. Suppose I don't want to drink anything at all, or suppose I want a carrot, right? That's not in the equation at all. And so what algorithms do is try to predict the future and then push people towards that prediction.
Well, let's talk about a prime user of the algorithm that is much in the news these days, Facebook. 2 billion people approximately worldwide, millions, of course, tens of millions in the United States. I'm a user of Facebook. I'm on Facebook. And it's implicated in one of the principal controversies of our time right now. Did the Russians meddle in and ultimately influence the election?
What Kathy starts out by saying when I ask this towards the end of the discussion is Facebook has the data to figure this out. We can find out scientifically if these advertisements influence the election, but they haven't done that math. They haven't done the study. So we are now guessing, and she doesn't like to guess. She's a mathematician. She does not like to guess. So the first question is, did they affect the election? And we don't know. Did they interfere with the election? Absolutely. So is that Facebook's fault, or is that solely the Russians' fault? Kathy also thinks it's Facebook's fault because, as she puts it, they get advertisements by showing how effective Facebook is when you advertise on it. And so then they can't come along and say, well, we're not responsible for the effectiveness of the ads, because they've proven that they can. So the problem ultimately is that Facebook has gotten so large and so powerful that A, it's not going to do anything that we don't want it to do, but B, we focus on Facebook when we should be focusing on other things, like the fact that there are all these algorithms to determine whether or not to hire someone for a job, or there are these algorithms that determine whether a teacher is a good teacher or not. And these are inaccurate often, they're unchallengeable often, and they are oblique. We don't know what those algorithms are or what information. And so the other problem with Facebook, in addition to the Russia stuff, is that it dominates the headlines so much that we're only talking about Facebook and we're not talking about the other stuff, which we may have a better shot at fixing than we would with Facebook.
Well, let's get into this. Is the algorithm the new objective truth that governs important decisions?
That's an awesome question. And this goes to the heart of our discussion, because I don't know what objective means, and she doesn't know what objective means in that sense. Is an algorithm objective the way that 1 plus 1 equals 2 is objective? No, of course not, because there's human judgment involved. First of all, the data that we use isn't always the exact data that we want. Let's go back to my comment about crimes and arrests. We don't have data on crimes, so we use arrests as a proxy for crime. Another example, we don't have data on people's health, so we ask people, how far can you run, or what do you weigh? And so these proxies get put into the algorithm, and then the algorithm are designed for certain things: profits, maximizing clicks, efficiency, minimizing the number of teachers, something like that. So there's no objectivity in the data that we use, and there's no objectivity in the algorithm. So even though it looks like math and it looks like science, it's not objective at all.
Well, and the conundrum here is that the widespread use of algorithms, for example, by consumers of social media or online marketing, make them even more powerful, more influential.
That's right. The algorithm decides who my friends are, right? Or at least who I see. I mean, I've got 1,000 friends from all over the world from the radio show, and I see 15 of them, you know? And so why? Because Facebook decided I get ads for whatever I get ads for. Here's an interesting thing. She and I actually didn't talk about this, but this is one of my favorite examples of the shortcomings, right? Let's say you go to Amazon and you buy some window blinds. Well, over for the next week, when you're on Amazon, when you're on Facebook, when you're on the internet, because of the cookies, all you ever see are advertisements for window blinds, right? But those are the least likely thing you're going to buy. That's what it looks like when an algorithm fails, right? It becomes so obvious and so ineffective that it doesn't have any effect on us. But that's not dangerous. What's dangerous is when it can predict what it thinks you want accurately, and so then you end up buying things that you don't want, having a political opinion that you're susceptible to but maybe shouldn't have, or missing out on information from a friend that you would love to know because it's giving you fake news.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. You can hear it at 5 on Sunday, Central Time, on Prairie Public's radio network. Jack, news aggregators are very common online. Some aggregators have objectives that affect what kind of news is collected and how it's presented. And that has been reflected in these sort of political repercussions and discussions that now become widespread. I mean, an opinion can circle the world before the truth does, obviously.
I read this wonderful book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Kathy didn't write it, but it's about these people who got famous for doing something terrible and how it affected their life. So there was a woman who was about to fly to, I think, Australia, and she posted to a friend on Twitter a sort of offensive joke, and then she turned off her phone and landed 12 hours later, and the tweet had gone worldwide. She had a voicemail message from her boss saying that she was fired for being a racist, and she became a pariah. all of this happened without her knowing it. All this happened while she was over the ocean, and all this happened because of a one-time comment. Now, I'm not qualified to judge whether she is a racist or not. She certainly seemed like a nice woman and not a racist in the book. It was just a bad joke that actually came off differently than she wanted it to. Nevertheless, we all make mistakes. We all do stupid things. We all step out of our house in our underwear to get the newspaper every once in a while. When I was 15 and I would do that silly things, or when I was college, I would do those things, it would die 60 seconds later. Or if someone took a picture of it, there'd be a picture that I could hold or I could tear up. Now, everything we do is global. Everything we do can become viral instantaneously, and then it never goes away. That picture in our underwear will never come off the internet, no matter what. Now, I myself happen to look very good in my underwear, so people might enjoy it. But nevertheless, right, we don't have control over these things. And the news aggregators create a sense that we do have control, because they create a sense that the world operates the way we like it to or want it to. And I don't mean that we get everything that we want, but it makes us think, if we're a supporter of Trump, everybody supports Trump, and those crazy liberals, they're awful. Or if we're a liberal, it makes us think everyone's a liberal and those crazy conservatives don't know anything. And it messes with our reality. So now we have this 1-2 punch. We don't accurately know what reality is, so we're more inclined to say or do things that are shocking. And then once we say or do things that are shocking, it becomes entertainment for the world, and then it seems much more essential to who we are than it really is.
Jack, when we talk about intellectual property, algorithms fit that category. And considering their widespread use and potential potency, are they not the weapons of the future?
Well, they are certainly, in Kathy's words, the weapons of math destruction. And they are intellectual property in that we don't know what they are. No one has seen Facebook's algorithm. It's a secret.
Should
no
these be proprietary?
They're intellectual property. They appear to be proprietary. Whether or not a subpoena should be allowed to declare that someone gets to see them, I don't know. That seems to make sense. But they are weapons in a variety of ways, right? They can be weapons in the most literal sense, in that they can create attacks on computers and on other countries.
Financial records, electrical grids.
That's right. They can consume us with spam or viruses, but they can also be weapons in the fact that they drown out voices, right? Maybe Hillary Clinton said a bunch of things that might have convinced some Trump supporters that she wasn't the wrong person after all. But they didn't get to see that because the Trump supporters were victims of algorithms that completely and utterly dominated their point of view. So it was only Trump all the time. Flip side, maybe some Hillary Clinton supporters might have thought that, well, you know, this Trump is crazy, but maybe he has some really good ideas and I should give him the benefit of the doubt. But they didn't get to see those good ideas because the algorithms decided that they would only show pro-Hillary, anti-Trump propaganda. And so it's a weapon in the smaller sense that it hurts us and limits our ability to think, and we don't know it. And sometimes the weapons that we don't know are there are the worst weapons.
Well, this is a feast for thought.
It absolutely is.
And I encourage our listeners to tune in to Jack Russell Weinstein's Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. This Sunday, the topic is, does big data threaten our democracy? He'll be talking with Kathy O'Neill. She's a mathematician and author, and he's referenced the book Weapons of Math Destruction. You can hear it on Prairie Public Presents Sunday at 5 p.m. Central. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Doug, as always.
Coming up next, Harvest Public Media on the growing trade war.
The ability of technology to manipulate and alter reality is growing at a breakneck speed.
Will technology blind us to the difference between what is real and what is fake news?
That's terrifying.
Is what I'm seeing true?
Oh, God.
Is what I'm hearing real? How do you have a democracy where people can't trust anything that they see or read?
Breaking news on the next Radiolab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The potential of a trade war between the U.S. and China has farmers caught in the middle. And today, President Trump upped the ante with China by threatening a new $100 billion tariff plan. Earlier this week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's top trade official traveled to Nebraska and got an earful. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach was there.
Farmers say they feel like a punching bag as the U.S. and China spar on trade.
This administration seems prone to whatever the spur-of-the-moment thoughts are that pop into the president's head, and I'm not sure that that message is finally reaching the top like it should.
That's Bart Ruth, who farms corn and soybeans near Rising City in eastern Nebraska. He was at Wednesday's roundtable with farmers in Omaha. It was held in a machine shed with antique tractors in the background and frustrated farmers gathered around tables. Each round of tariffs that the U.S. proposes or imposes, China has countered with its own taxes on American products. That list now includes pork, wine, and fruit. Soybeans, beef, and corn could be next. As the Undersecretary for Trade at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it's Ted McKinney's job to build and grow markets for American farm exports. He was at the roundtable and says, yes, tariffs are hurting those exports. But he says unfair trade practices are hurting the entire economy.
China is not playing by the rules, period. Now, in agriculture, it's rampant with stolen seed germplasm. About 20 miles from my home, a feed company had some intellectual property stolen. And so this is an attempt by the president to say there's probably no good time to do this kind of thing, but we've got to get China to play by the rules.
A lot of the reaction from farmers and farm groups were, this is just what we feared. Mm-hmm. So especially with the farm economy struggling the way it has been, what is your message to farmers who are working through hard times right now?
My message is just to be a bit more patient. Hang in there just a little bit. I think this president will have their backs.
No, I'm not particularly feeling patient today, yeah.
Bart Ruth, who has worked with the American Soybean Association, says the tariffs could dismantle decades of work in making China a major export market.
I had a lot of patience building these markets, and to see it threatened in a trade war that really makes no sense is very disheartening.
Republican U.S. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska helped organize the roundtable. He says the administration should back off on the tariffs and pressure China by joining more trade alliances.
A trade war is stupid. A trade war is painful. A trade war is unnecessary. And we need the administration to hear clearly from the people who are feeding the world why they want to keep feeding the world. And they want government and their trade wars and their tariffs to stay out of the way.
Conflict with China may be the current focus, McKinney says, but he thinks some of the unrest will be settled by wrapping up trade deals with South Korea, Canada, and Mexico, and by opening talks with Japan.
I hope that gives a little bit of comfort to our friends in the farmery and ranching community who might be wondering what's going on.
Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue has said he's told President Trump that farmers need exports. I asked McKinney if that message is getting through.
Absolutely, unequivocally, yes. And he's asking, as I'm asking, for just a little patience. Again, we're just now digesting all this recent news on tariffs. But there's more to play.
Looking ahead, farmer Don Wesley of Morse Bluff, Nebraska, says he hopes the dispute can be settled within a couple weeks. By then, he'll be planting corn, and he'll have enough on his mind.
If we can get past this sooner than later, then we can go back to dealing with Mother Nature and all the problems we're used to, I guess, as farmers.
Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
Coming up on Main Street, our weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson. And another Friday regular, film reviewer Matt Olean offers his opinion about Ready Player One. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota is getting ready to launch a new effort to fight distracted driving. Beginning Monday, Minnesota law enforcement will step up its efforts to spot drivers using their phones and other things while behind the wheel. State Traffic Safety Director Mike Hansen.
We need to change our culture. We need to change our habits, and we need to change the way we behave behind the wheel. It takes each of us making that conscious decision when we get in the car that I am not going to text, that I am not going to Snapchat, I'm not going to check Facebook, I'm going to pay attention, and I'm going to put the phone away.
Members of NDSU's TKA fraternity and Kappa Delta sorority are continuing a decades-long tradition with a fundraiser to help a well-known cause.
We're raising money for St. Jude. Just trying to help the kids out as much as possible. Okay, but one of the members started kind of doing this, and we've just been doing it since the 70s now.
Nick Porzinski, a student from Park Rapids, was bundled up in layers of clothing against the bitter cold wind chills early this morning at the donation site at 12th Avenue and North University Drive in Fargo. The cold weather doesn't stop a fundraiser for a great cause. You can watch those students give a donation. They're set up in the parking lot at the Loaf and Jug until Saturday. And frigid temperatures are lingering over the state. Forecasters say another winter storm is heading into North Dakota this weekend. Brittany Peterson is a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Bismarck. She says a northwest wind combined with low temperatures are keeping conditions quite cold throughout the weekend. She says a winter weather system moving in on Sunday will affect much of North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota.
Now, that's mainly expected to bring snowfall accumulating along and south of Interstate 94, with the heaviest patches of snow looking at this point to be from about Bismarck to Watertown, South Dakota. So generally for like the Fargo and Valley City areas, we're looking at about 3 to 5 inches. The same toward, as you're going down along I-94 toward Fergus Falls, about the same amount. Now, if that axis shifts north or south, we could see a little bit more or less, but looking up more into northeast North Dakota and northwest Minnesota, little to probably no accumulation expected from that system.
Peterson says winter storms this late in the season are not terribly uncommon, but it has been particularly cold this spring. She says temperatures have been much colder than normal, approaching record lows. She says the middle of the week next week should see temperatures reaching the 30s and 40s, but it still may be a couple more weeks before spring feels like it's finally here to stay. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Jeff and Ann Clark, in loving memory of their son, Todd Clark.
Well, the sound of that old wire machine in the background means it's time for a couple of old news hounds to talk about the week's news. And, of course, the big news this week has been the trade war, or the potential
correct,
for
yes.
one. That's the more correct way to say that. So let's talk about that for a moment here. Today, the president upped the ante, talking about a $100 billion tariff plan. But whatever it is, soybeans have already been put in the mix, wheat and sorghum and all kinds of stuff that will affect people who are listening to us.
And then soybeans, to talk to the soybean growers in North Dakota, they say that's a $1.7 billion hit to the economy of North Dakota if that tariff goes in place and the Chinese quit buying. And already the Chinese have canceled a couple of orders. They don't know if it's related to tariffs or not. There's some suspicion it is. But it could really be a blow to North Dakota's economy.
Yeah, and the futures markets are likely going to be affected just by talk of it.
That's right. And you see the stock markets being affected too.
Oh, it's down very sharply. We'll see whether there's any upward trend near the close, but it's been a rocky day for the stock market
has.
As well. You did have a story, though, earlier this week where you came across somebody talking about soybeans who saw there was a potential for a positive sign.
Right, and I talked to this grower from Barnes County. He said, yeah, we don't like what the tariff might do immediately, but if there's a way the president can convince China to try to balance things out, maybe the soybean industry could help by selling more soybeans to China. China is a huge market because they use soybeans for lots of stuff. They
sure.
use it for animal feed. They use it for condiments. They use it in just regular food.
And, of course, pork has already been mentioned as one of those other
yes.
Pieces that might be involved in this tariff increase. And North Dakota produces pork and, as you just mentioned,
right,
soybean and lots of grains are used to feed pork too.
So. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about the other big event. You're going to it. That's the Republican convention at the Alera Center in Grand Forks. At least one big race up there. It's still hanging out there.
Right. And we're talking about the U.S. House race, which is an open seat for the first time in a long, long time. Well, not a real long time, because 6 years ago, Rick Berg was in the House and then he wanted to move to the Senate. So that became an open seat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Kevin Cramer got elected, if you remember correctly.
And of course, we got that big race between Kevin Cramer and Heidi Heitkamp with lots of money at play. And
there's going to be a lot of money, yes.
So what are you looking for at this convention?
I think it's going to be interesting to see because it seems like the anointed person might be Senator Armstrong from Dickinson. However, Senator Campbell been out there for a long time, you know, talking to delegates, spending a lot of money, and I don't think it's necessarily settled yet because you actually have seven candidates vying here. So they may get a chunk of it here, a chunk of it there. And the rules is you have to have 50% plus one delegate. So if somebody doesn't get 50% plus one delegate, it could be who drops out and where those delegates go.
Well, you mentioned Rick Berg is the current chair of the Republican Party in North Dakota. And Kelly Armstrong was the former chair.
Former chair, right.
And Rick Berg made a ruling this week about another controversial element of this race, which was Tom Campbell's paying the registration fees for quite a few delegates.
Right. And apparently he's saying that the names of the delegates are not going to be released, even though several members of the media have talked about who are these delegates for Tom Campbell, and can we talk to them? Can we have a list of them? And I guess they're not going to do that.
Well, he gave them kind of a deadline to refund or to pay their own registration fees, and then they wouldn't have their names released. So
that's right.
Apparently, lots of them chose to do that.
It's interesting. I think that race has – there's some other undertones in this race in terms of you've seen the ads or heard the ads. Who is the most conservative? So you're getting that out there. And again, Tom Campbell was out working very early. And here comes Kelly Armstrong from Dickinson, who came in a lot later. So we'll see what the dynamic is there. There was also the dynamic, is Tom Campbell going to challenge in the primary? He seems to have been waffling on that a little bit. But we thought going into this that if he did not win the race, he would challenge in the primary.
Well, we know that as a good former chair, Kelly Armstrong probably wouldn't want to say that.
Kelly Armstrong said he would not.
Okay. Well, let's move across the river for just a moment here because there was a big announcement yesterday in Minnesota. Former two-term Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty has thrown his hat into that race again.
I find that extremely interesting because he was a two-term governor, did not seek another term.
He wanted to be vice president with John McCain.
He wanted to be vice president with John McCain. And then he toyed with the idea of running for president as well. In 2012. Now he's going back and he's saying, well, maybe I should be governor again. And I know that it's causing a little tension within the Minnesota Republican Party. It's very interesting to hear some of the candidates saying, do we really want him back? Because he might cause some divisions in the party. Yet he's got name recognition and a former two-term governor. So he might have a leg up too.
Well, he famously set a record for vetoes in Minnesota as he was leaving.
Yeah, absolutely.
34 vetoes in basically one session, and that stands.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about the applications for the North Dakota Board of Higher Education.
There are some interesting names on that list. And when I started covering the Board of Higher Education, Dr. Tyrone Longauger from Minot was on the board, and now he's reapplied for the board, which I find very interesting. I haven't had a chance to talk to him, but I remember talking to him a lot when he was on the board the first time around. And there are some other names, Dan Traynor, for example, that's a familiar name. Tom Seymour is a familiar name, people who have been around the legislative session or in and out of state government. And other names, Alan Scramstead, he was with UND, and he was with UND Aerospace. And then I don't know Gregory Stites. I know Rick Becker, who was on our board.
Well, when they put this board together, are they looking at some sort of geographical balance?
They're going to try to. That's been an unwritten rule that there would be geographical balance.
Uh-huh.
And the concern is if you had Tom Seymour on the board, that may be too Fargo since he now lives in Fargo.
Hmm.
And I know that there are a lot of things that will go into that. And it's always interesting to go to the meeting of that commission that looks at making the recommendation because the Chief Justice of the North Dakota Supreme Court is on it. Superintendent of Public Instruction is on it. The head of North Dakota United is on it. And then one representative from the Senate, one representative from the House.
And their principal employee, the Chancellor, is under a bit of a cloud.
Yes, at this point, that's right.
Well, let's move on to another issue that might be on the ballot, and that is recreational marijuana.
Yeah, the organizers say they're more than halfway in terms of getting the number of petition signatures to get it on the November ballot. That's what they're hoping to do. And, of course, this happens before, and I, as a veteran newsman yourself, you'll understand this when I say this has happened before the state fair.
Ah, because
the state fair is one of those things where you can get a lot of signatures. And that's why a lot of petition organizers go to the state fair.
You attended a big meeting in about coal in mm-hmm. North Dakota this week, and it attracted a lot of attention.
It did.
And I've seen a fair amount of stuff come out of it. It looked to me like it was a sort of a rah-rah coal meeting because
it really was.
They're looking at the reduced regulations because mm-hmm. of the Trump administration and possibility of monetizing some of the stuff that we've been worried about.
Right. And if you want to look at the record of our congressional delegation, two Republicans, one Democrat, they're all very much interested in a path forward for lignite coal, whether mm-hmm. it be clean coal technology or using it for enhanced oil recovery, carbon dioxide, using carbon dioxide as a commodity itself. So there's all sorts of things going on, and the Energy and Environmental Research Center is doing a lot of research on it, and EERC has done a lot of partnering with the Lignite Energy Council.
And in your story, I was very intrigued to see another China connection there because we've got these rare earth elements that are very important to electronics, manufacturing, mm-hmm. and all that. A lot of them have been coming from China, but apparently they show up in lignite.
Right. There have been a couple studies. EERC has done a study. The Geological Survey has done a study that either embedded in the lignite itself or in the beds underneath the lignite, you will find these rare earth metals and elements. And they're saying, okay, if we can find a way to refine them and get them to the electronics makers, then maybe we're going to be less dependent on China.
Hmm. There was a meeting this week with Heidi Heitkamp, and a lot of people nationwide and in North Dakota are worried about their defined benefit pensions. And specifically, we're talking about the Central States Pension Fund. And, for example, Teamsters or UPS drivers, those kinds of people are involved in this fund. They were paying into it for, in
right.
many cases, 30 years and were expecting a certain outcome, and that's in question.
And remember, some companies went with that pension fund rather than having their own pension fund. They said, okay, we can have somebody else manage this for us. Well, now things have gone south and there's some concern that maybe the funds won't be there. And that's why they're looking at some kind of fix to make sure that people who were expecting to have their pension funds from Central States, that they will have money available to them.
I spoke with an activist, Dennis Curran, earlier this mm-hmm. week. As a matter of fact, he'll be featured on our Sunday Main Street weekend show, which is 10 Central. Do a little plug there.
Why not?
But Dennis was talking about his own personal experience. He's 30 years as a retired now UPS driver, and he would have his benefits literally cut in half under the proposal that they've been fighting. And that would be from $2,600 to $1,300. So it's not a drop in the bucket. It's
not a drop
important.
In the bucket. And if you add that to Social Security, that doesn't really make up the difference for those defined benefit plans.
An electric co-op will serve a new grain handling facility near Morton, and it's Dakota Valley as opposed to Otter Tail Power Company. What was going on there?
Okay. Well, the company, which was Minn Kota, wanted Otter Tail Power Company to serve. One reason that was stated is because Dakota Valley was serving an existing plant in the Wahpeton area, and they apparently had some power problems. Well, that's only one item that a Public Service Commission takes a look at. They're trying to do orderly development so there's not duplication of infrastructure. And when Otter Tail presented to the commission, it said that it was going to build a substation and a line just to serve the Minn Kota plant, whereas Dakota Valley has existing infrastructure there and will serve other customers, including the Minn Kota plant. They said if you let Otter Tail do it, that would be, you know, redundant infrastructure.
All right. Let's end with the Friends of the Bridge, which mm-hmm. is formed to save that Burlington Northern Santa Fe bridge between Bismarck and Mandan.
The 1883 bridge, yes.
That's an old bridge, but it's still in good shape, I take it.
It's still in good shape, but it's not good enough for modern rail traffic as the trains get longer and heavier.
But we could walk across it.
But you can walk across it, and that's what they're trying to do. And how to fund it? Apparently, BNSF in some cases has put endowment funds, you know, from the money they were going to use to tear down bridges. They put endowment funds, and groups can use the endowment funds, the proceeds, for the upkeep, to keep them maintained.
So that's a possibility?
It's a possibility. Apparently BNSF is open to discussion.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have our news director right here in the studio with me.
Thank you, Doug.
All right. Coming up next, Matt Olien reviews a new movie.
Programming on Prairie Public is supported by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 138 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
President Trump promised to defend the country from all threats, foreign and domestic. We just never anticipated that the threat would be free 2-day shipping. We'll ask Alexa, what's up with that? Plus, we'll talk to Ohio Governor John Kasich in Columbus about the days when politics were sane, mostly. Join us for this week's news quiz from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Lights, camera, action, and special effects. It's time to talk about another movie. This is a pretty big one by a very well-known director. Matt Olien joins us to talk about Ready Player One.
Yeah, so this finally knocked Black Panther off the top slot at the box office weekend. Black Panther had been unbeatable for weeks and weeks, but clearly this is Steven Spielberg, one of his biggest openings in quite a long time. You probably have to go back to War of the Worlds and some of the films he did like that. This is the kind of film he does very well, and I'll get to that in a minute. But it's based on a novel by Ernest Cline. It was his debut novel, and it was a big deal, and he sold the rights to it for a lot of money. There was a lot of people that wanted to get a hold of this novel. It takes place in Columbus, Ohio in 2045 in the future, and there's everyone lives in poverty. Most people do, including our protagonist, played by Ty Sheridan. He plays a kid named Wade Watts.
So this is a dark view of the near future.
Dark view of the near future, but also with that kind of Spielberg happiness to it. And I'll get to that in a second. So Wade Watts lives in poverty with his mom and kind of this awful boyfriend she dates. But his escape is through virtual reality, and he's able to go into a virtual reality game that everyone loves called The Oasis. And it was founded by a guy named James Halliday, who's played by Mark Rylance, who is Spielberg's go-to actor these days, Bridge of Spies, The BFG. And Simon Pegg plays the guy who co-founded The Oasis. Now, the trick of the film is Halliday's character has passed away, but he's left a clue in a game. And whoever can complete the game and find this egg will be the controller of the Oasis and kind of have the keys to the kingdom. And so through all this gaming, Watts meets a girl. She also has an avatar. They have avatars in their game, Doug. So they don't really know who they are in real life, but he likes her and she's interesting. She's got funky hair as her avatar and she's played by Olivia Cooke. So they begin this adventure. But of course, there's the evil corporate interests at work, played by Ben Mendelsohn, who's sort of the evil guy who sort of tried to inherit the company by Halliday, and he wants control, and so that's really the plot line. What I mean by this is what Spielberg does best is he's very good at directing kid actors or near-adolescent actors or almost adult actors, and that's what he's got here. Many of his films over the years, Doug, we have the protagonists as kids or teenagers, and the villains are the adults. And this plays into Spielberg's, you know, his motif of his whole career, which is the kid who never grew up. That's really who he is. He's done a lot of serious films as well. But after The Post, which I didn't care for, I know a lot of people like The Post, which came out last year. I thought it was sort of strained seriousness by Spielberg, kind of a C-grade attempt to outdo All the President's Men in terms of a newspaper movie. It's good to see him back doing this. Now, he's aided by the visual effects. This is a heavy CGI film, but you've still got that Spielberg touch. The film moves fast. You feel like you're right in there with them in the virtual reality. I loved a part of the film where they go into the film of The Shining and they try to find clues to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining and they kind of go inside the film.
So there's
That's a great sequence.
There's a lot of retro stuff in this.
Yes, this is a lot of pop culture references. People will love that who grew up in the 80s, a lot of 80s references. Like I said, the Kubrick thing with The Shining is fascinating when they go kind of inside the film. You almost feel like you're into the film.
Wow.
With the hallways and the creepy twin girls, that kind of thing. But the film kind of runs out of gas with the last 10, 15 minutes. It's a little too long, Doug. I felt like it had a breakneck pace up to that point. And then I felt like there were like three climaxes, like when's it going to end? But overall, I was in the right mood for this film. I think I was in the right mood to see Spielberg do what he does best. And so I would give it a pretty enthusiastic thumbs up.
Well, I watched the trailer and it really intrigued me. So I'm looking forward to seeing this movie. I also read a little bit from Spielberg talking about the film, and he said it was one of the toughest ones he's ever had to do.
Oh, I'm sure it is. I mean, directing CGI stuff is tricky when you have to use your actors, knowing that it's going to be a lot of CGI later. That's got to be a hard thing to do. You know, I've complained on this program about too much CGI over the years, and we've kind of been bombarded. A Wrinkle in Time, for example, I felt overused the CGI. It sort of looked like a Mardi Gras parade at times. This time, I think the CGI is important, and it's crucial to the film because most of the action takes place in the virtual world. I must say, the message of the film is a little confusing. You kind of get this sense of, you know, he's trying to preach that, hey, reality is still where we want to be. But in fact, people like to be in the virtual world because their reality in 2045 Ohio isn't very good. So I got the feeling Spielberg was giving us a little bit of mixed messages there on what's the best thing to be, real or virtual.
So you said this has had a pretty big opening.
Yes.
Was it a full theater when you went?
Not when we went, but we went on a Monday night at the end of Easter weekend. So over the weekend, though, it was pretty packed. I think Spielberg's films can still draw audiences. But I think the big thing here is that a lot of people read the book. A lot of people love the pop culture references. We have references to 80s films, 80s music, Rubik's Cubes, all kinds of stuff in there that people are going to like and enjoy.
Well, I know you've interested in this film. You like it. Mm-hmm. I know critics also look at other critics. So what are the critics saying?
I think in general they've liked it. I want to say about 3/4 of them have liked it on Rotten Tomatoes, among the top critics, as they're called. So I think in general this is a good film. I think it's better than some of his more recent films, although I like Bridge of Spies a lot. So Spielberg's a guy who can go back and forth between – he can do Schindler's List and Jurassic Park in the same year. Mm. That famously, he did that in 93.
Wow.
There's not many directors that can have that big of a swath. You know, a Scorsese film is a Scorsese film. Martin Scorsese doesn't vary too much from kind of the nuts and bolts of what he does. Neither does Woody Allen. But Spielberg has often gone back and forth between, oh, let's do The Color Purple and then let's do another Indiana Jones film. And sometimes the results are mixed and sometimes they work. I like that he went from The Post to this because I wasn't as wild about The Post as a lot of people were.
Well, as our listeners know, we try to test your knowledge of mm-hmm. Oscar history. Every week when you do a review, we ask you an Oscar trivia question. And today I'm kind of going to break the mold just a little bit because I'm not looking for a winner here.
Okay.
What I'm looking for here is this film was disqualified from receiving an Academy Award nomination for special effects because the Academy felt at the time that using computers was cheating.
Do you have a year for me?
1982 was the year the movie was made. It starred a very well-known actor who's, think the son of Sea Hunt.
Oh, what? Tron with Jeff Bridges.
There
is
you
that
go.
What we're looking for?
Yes, that's what that was.
Yeah.
It. And now that's.
I don't think I'd have got that otherwise.
That's Oscar trivia. Another piece of trivia here is actually more recent. The animated trailer for this video game was eligible to be nominated for the Oscars in this year, in animated short film. It was not nominated ultimately, but it was eligible for the very first time. A trailer about a video game.
A trailer about a video game was eligible.
It was created by David O'Reilly.
Okay.
It's called Everything.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not familiar with that one.
I've got to look for it, actually, because I've just seen stills from the video.
Okay.
It looks very intriguing, but it looks like we're – with all of this CGI,
yeah,
all of these special effects, video games and movies are starting to cross paths.
Yeah, and I think what works with this film, Doug, is that we know it's going to be CGI going in because that's what the book was about. It's all about virtual reality. So if you commit to it, and they did here, then things work out better than normal.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This week on Away With Words, we're carbo-loading on mac and cheese and a pint of beer.
I was having a debate on Facebook, of course, with a buddy of mine about the mac in mac and cheese. And we're wondering if the mac was short for macaroni or if the mac was an acronym for macaroni and cheese.
Join us.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 6th. Graham's Island is a large island in Devil's Lake, covering about 9 square miles. On this date in 1906, the Devil's Lake Inter-Ocean newspaper reported on draft legislation that would reserve Graham's Island for the use of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians. The plan was to set the land aside for homestead allotments. 2 years earlier, in 1904, the Turtle Mountain Chippewa had ceded to the United States all the land they still claimed in North Dakota. The only exception was a small tract, 12 miles long and 6 miles wide. At that time, it was stipulated that any Chippewa unable to secure land in that area could take claim of any vacant government land without charge. The federal government determined that Graham's Island was the only vacant land in the area. The island had been used as a wood reservation for Fort Totten, but had since been abandoned. The island's name comes from Captain Duncan Graham, a Scotsman fur trader for the Hudson's Bay Company. He arrived in North Dakota long before the influx of homesteaders. It's thought that he arrived in the area of Devil's Lake about 1810. He is acknowledged as the first white settler in the area. He settled on a piece of land near what is now the city of Devil's Lake and built a trading post on the island. The Indians called him Bigfoot, and the island was called Bigfoot's Island. Graham's Island is now home to a state park. There are ample opportunities for camping, fishing, boating, and picnicking. The park hosts fishing tournaments on Devil's Lake, which covers more than 100,000 acres, and has walleye, northern pike, white bass, and perch. The area also attracts hunters in the fall as thousands of waterfowl migrate through this treasured recreation area. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
National Guard troops to the border, Facebook to the Capitol, a tit-for-tat with China on tariffs.
For many years, no president wanted to go against China economically, and we're going to do it.
We'll run down the news and look to the week ahead on our political chat this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered comes up next here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, George Bible, UND Professor of Mechanical Engineering, will talk about his new book, Plane Crash, The Forensics of Aviation Disasters. And the North Country National Scenic Trail is a footpath stretching 4,600 miles from eastern North Dakota to Lake Sakakawea State Park in North Dakota. Dakota Prairie Chapter member Bob Stein will join us Monday to talk about the trail. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we invite you to take in Main Street Weekend this Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.